Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Stone Cold Shots, the professional wrestling podcast where the shots are cold and the takes are hot. Every episode here, every other week, we review, we rate,
recap
a professional wrestling pape. This week we're doing something a little different, but we'll get into that in a minute. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves to the Stone Cold Shots universe. Tell them your name and tell them if there's a current wrestler who has never been gone to WWE, but you think, man, the matches that this guy or girl or non-gender specific person would have, who do you want to see? Who's someone that has traveled the world, has made a name for themselves, you know, and they just never ended up in the Fed?
I know.
Okay, well, introduce yourself.
My name's Lauren. I'm a regular darling. And I think Luchasaurus would just thrive in WWE. I think he's a big fucking hoss-ass man. He's got the tattoos. He's got the mask. He's got the whole look. And he can talk if he needs to. He's got that really deep, sexy voice. And he's really smart. And he would do well in the WWE acting school. And I think Luchasaurus would kill it. Are you going to tell me that he's already been in WWE? Are you about to just stomp my whole idea?
He was... Austin Mattelson was one of the original class of NXT.
What a fucking bad name that is.
Yeah. That's probably why he didn't make it. But he could come back. He could do a whole ass thing now.
You know, I'm going to say that doesn't count because he wasn't Luchasaurus.
Sure.
All right.
He wasn't a dinosaur man yet.
Well, I'm the internet darling, Josh Felix Pryor, and I think, you know, of all the young studs out there, of all the this and that's, and, you know, all the people that can really use an opportunity, I think a young upstart like MJF would do really well in the WWE.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I feel like I think he would cut his teeth pretty well there, and I think he would manage his way around the old Fed pretty well.
Can you imagine he would be
running the place by now?
Yeah, oh. Can you imagine him with Kevin Owens? What horrible bullies they would be to people.
But like, honestly, I think MJF he's like what, 24 years old at this point. If I had like an actual guess, I would say Sammy Guevara. Like that would be like my, because I feel like if you plucked him out now, like out of like the inner circle, kind of like the blog stuff he's doing, I think Sammy Guevara would do the best in the Performance Center. And I think they could like have an actual run with him, but
he would be main eventing 205 Live in no time.
But that's it, right? Like I worry about Sammy Guevara in an environment like that because, you know, like, what would they do with him? You know?
Yeah, I don't know if they would do everything that he could do, you know?
I mean, look at, like, if a guy like Ricochet is in the position he's in.
Yeah.
Like, Sammy Guevara is, you know.
Absolutely.
Sammy Guevara has got, like, more of a personality than Ricochet, though, right? Like, so I think...
Sure.
He could potentially fare better, but I don't... Yeah, I don't know. MJF, obviously, is the only answer for this.
Well, I'm nobody's darling. I'm your heel host, Campbell Falconer.
Boo!
And, I think, Josh, I kind of took this question the same way that you're taking it, of like, who do I think could thrive in that environment?
Hey, that's how I took it, too. I stand by Luchasaurus.
Sure.
All right.
And Josh, I'm really surprised that, like, sometimes I kind of tailor these questions so that you can say Jay White, because I know how much you love King Switch.
Oh, we weren't even thinking in that direction.
But my answer is not Jay White.
Oh!
My answer is fucking Brian Cage. You don't think Vince McMahon is looking at that pile of meat and just like salivating?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's hard for Cage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm hard for Cage, too.
Can you imagine him being like, let's put Cage in a cage match?
But, like, I don't know. I just think, like, I would love to see Cage, like, Cage Roman Reigns, Cage Kevin Owens,
Cage Keith Lee. Like, what was that?
Yeah, Cage Keith Lee, for sure. Now. Yeah. That's a dude that I would...
Okay,
like,
let's back up.
I don't want to see him leave AEW, but...
Yeah. But Jay White. Like, let's talk about Jay White in the Fed. That guy's got a star fucking staple to his asshole. That guy's going to be money no matter where he goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. I feel like WWE doesn't deserve him.
I agree. Lauren, 100%.
Well, if you ask Jay White, New Japan doesn't deserve him, so...
I think nobody deserves him. Nobody deserves Jay White.
We'll see what ends up happening with that storyline. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, speaking of Sammy Guevara main eventing 205 Live, Josh decided that we would go back and revisit 2016's inaugural and only Cruiserweight Classic. Take us through, like, why, dude? I'm not complaining. Like, I fucking loved the Cruiserweight Classic, but you came in hot with this suggestion. You were like, yo, we gotta watch the Cruiserweight Classic for the pod. Like, what kicked that off?
Yeah, so, I was just, as you all know, I'm a subscriber to YouTube Premium, and I watch a lot of YouTube all day, every day. And, I got in my suggestions the lineup for the Cruiserweight Classic, and I was watching it. Mm-hmm. I was just letting it play in the background, and I was like, damn, like, there's some, like, serious fucking competitors in this. And, like, you know, I remember, like, people like Kota Ibushi and things like that, but if you look at most of the landscape now, a lot of it's made up from this tournament, like, through NXT, through Impact, through New Japan, through, like, whatever it is, like, there's a lot of big hitters in this tournament, and I was like, this would probably yield some pretty good matchups. So that's 100% my thinking. I'm like, why haven't we covered this, and let's get on it.
Where do you think Alejandro Saiz is now? You think he's still wrestling?
Yeah, he's probably the Triple A champion, if I'm not mistaken.
To both of you, did you watch the Cruiserweight Classic, like, when it was happening? Was that something that you were invested in, that you were checking out?
Yes. You, Campbell, and I watched it together. we were really excited about it. And I don't know. I remember the Cruiserweight Classic as being, like, a huge... I don't know if I want to say a revitalization or, like, a whole new discovery for me in wrestling, but I feel like it was a point in wrestling, and especially in WWE, where I was extremely excited about watching it every week, and I was really into all of these new wrestlers and really into the storylines, and I was, like, in a way that I wasn't necessarily feeling about main roster.
I think it's a thing where, like, looking back to the timeline of it, and not to put words in your mouth, like, tell me if this is wrong, but summer of 2016 would have been, like, in the absolute height of our Lucha Underground obsession.
Okay.
And I think that watching 205 Live was kind of like, oh... WWE is doing a Lucha Underground style match. WWE is doing, like, a really cool long-term tournament storytelling. Like, it was very much the NXTification of, like, a sort of, like, Lucha Libre, a lot of high-flying style.
That makes sense. That makes sense. If you told me so, I believe you. Like, I have such a shitty conception of A, memory, and B, just time. Like, I'm shocked that this Cruiserweight Classic took place in 2016. That seems like I probably only just started dating you in 2016, which is not accurate, but it just doesn't seem... It seems like such an absurdly early number. I don't know.
Yeah, guys, we didn't even know each other in 2016.
Yeah.
Really?
Can you imagine that? I feel like I've known you guys my entire fucking life.
Aww. Would we have been going to the contender at this point? Like, I have no idea where we were in our wrestling lives. Like, obviously we already knew Julian and we were hanging out with Julian.
We met at Great Balls of Fire, right? Does that sound right?
Which was probably around like 9 months after the Cruiserweight Classic,
okay,
I think.
Okay.
2017. July 9th, 2017.
Yeah.
Okay.
So about a year after.
Mm-hmm. So weird.
But yeah, Josh, what was your take on the Cruiserweight Classic
In
2016?
So I at the time, obviously, I didn't know a lot of these people, but it reminded me a lot of just Ring of Honor. Like, honestly, like having Moro and Daniel Bryan on commentary, I thought was excellent. I thought it was an excellent choice. I knew some of the people in there. I knew Johnny Gargano. I knew Tommaso Ciampa. I knew Kota Ibushi. I knew some of the players in there, but I really didn't know a lot of them. And, my main takeaway from the initial was, this is cool that WWE is doing it. And it's almost like, it's like hopeful. You know, like when it's like, it's really cool that they're doing this. And I was like, I'm really hopeful for the future because they're doing this, because it had such an indie, better than Evolve, I would say. Like, it had a different feel, like, you know what I mean? Like, it felt real. So at the time watching it, I was like, this is going to be awesome. And sure enough, it was awesome.
This was awesome.
But also, like, their show of faith in, like, they made a cruiserweight belt and division using this tournament, which was, I'm sure, like, something that they thought would be successful, and like they really wanted this to work out. And it was a really hopeful time. That's a great way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for the, I don't know, just like the cruiserweight division to come back. And, I think it's a lot to do with the network and, the chances they were taking on the network. I miss this time in the network. Cause if you remember around the same time, like they did those, the Beast in the East with like Brock Lesnar, going to Japan, but like then also like Kevin Owens and Finn Balor was on that card. And like, there was a lot
that match was fucking sick.
Yeah. Like there was a lot of cool stuff that was happening on the network.
Also, man, like that season of Tough Enough that they did that summer, I really liked with, where, and like the amount of people that have come out of that season of Tough Enough, where you have like Velveteen Dream, but like Mandy Rose, Sonya Deville, Chelsea Green was on that season. Like, there was some really cool shit that they were doing. Like, the network was really, really interesting. And with the news coming out this week of like the move to NBC and like looking at, like, maybe we're kind of past the golden age of the WWE network.
Which is weird to think about, because it seems like yesterday the network was just coming out. And then they went through this, like, kind of initial phase of, like, bringing in shows. And then they did this really cool stuff. And then, like, they were talking to Evolve and stuff like that. And buying out, different beds and stuff.
Bringing IWC. And they were also doing all of those, like, weird little shows of, like, like the Edge and Christian show, or like Swerved, or which were like really just like weird, fun, kind of out there things. And I think like, the Cruiserweight Classic, for my money, probably the best thing that they did.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So obviously we're not going to talk about every single match from the whole thing. We tried to get a good breadth of picks from the first round right through to the finals, get a good feel for the field of who was in this. So we're kicking it off hot with the last match of the first round. We have Johnny Gargano versus Tommaso Ciampa. We get a nice little video package here where they go through, it's been 1 year of them being a tag team and kind of like coming into NXT as singles wrestlers and being told that they were going to team up in the Dusty Cup and kind of rubbing against each other and then coming around to becoming a team. And like, this really made me like feel, you know, like just watching this and knowing like what is to come for this story. I felt like the video package like really, really drove it home and like hit the stakes. And I love these little like mini stories within a tournament that you're able to do here.
Yeah. And I feel like even at the time when we were watching this live, I think that all of the potential of this rivalry was so potent. Like at the time you could tell what was going to come. You couldn't tell who necessarily was going to turn, but you knew that there was so much potential about to happen, and it was going to break. And it was, you, I remember you and I were thinking it would happen right here for this match. Like we were like busting to figure out what would happen between these two best friends. A really cool moment in history with that feud.
Yeah, like honestly, and just like they planted a few seeds with Tommaso being like, you know, Johnny Wrestling and all this stuff, and you know, we'll get to in the match and stuff. And you think Tommaso is going to be the heel, but as it plays out, like it you know, he has a few moments of you know, like shying away from that and being like, I still love this guy. Which I would say, like, you know, building up to their actual, you know, like Tommaso's actual like heel turn, did it so much due diligence. And it, you know, if you pay attention to stories and you pay attention to timelines, you know, I think they paid it off so much better. And going back and watching this, I had forgot about this in context of their feud, right?
One is, it's my favorite thing about this is, and the way that it played out going forward is that like they were smart to not pull the trigger here.
Yes.
Where you have like the video package isn't, we are best friends and we have been through, like, it's like, we're good friends. You know, it's Tommaso Ciampa saying like, you know, like I came into this like wanting to be a single star and I got paired up with this guy and like we turned out to really like each other. He's getting married and I'm going to be part of his wedding. It's different from when the turn actually happened. And it's, you have another year, another 2 years on the story of their friendship. And it's not like, hey, I really like this guy, he asked me to be part of his wedding. It's like, this guy was my fucking brother and I brought him into my family. And it's, the way that they do it here is like, there's just enough history for them to tease it and make it an interesting story, but not enough history for them to actually pull the trigger on it. And I think they played it really well.
100%.
Yeah. I will say, so we get the video package and then we get like a weird little interview, and I feel like the interview kind of undercut the how good the video package was. I could have done without the interview.
It was a good interview though.
But it was,
yeah, like I think they were trying too hard to set the pace of the match and like who was going to be the heel, who was going to be the face, right?
The nuance of the video package was Johnny Gargano says, sometimes you fight family harder than you fight anyone else. And it's the idea of like, I love this guy, but I need to prove myself against him. And then in the interview, it's full on animosity and it's full on Ciampa is the heel. And it loses a little bit of the nuance that there was in the video package.
Yeah, Tommaso Ciampa's line for the music video that they hit hard is that, I never hit with the intention to injure, but I do hit with the intention to hurt, and I'm going to hurt you, Johnny Gargano.
Which I've said to both of you in the past, and I hope you both know it's only because I love you. You're like family to me.
So getting into the match, we have Johnny Gargano coming out to like the demo tape version of his Rebel Heart theme song.
It's so weird to hear it this way
without the vocals, the
lyrics.
But it's like, it got me fucking fired up, and like it was a thing where it's like, I can't wait for Johnny to come back around and make another face turn in current NXT so I can hear this song again.
Yeah.
Cause his like current heel entrance music is like generic as fuck. Speaking of which, Tommaso Ciampa comes out to the most
generic as fuck.
There was a little bit of it where it was like, okay, the bass line kind of sounds like Psycho Killer by the Talking Heads, because like his thing on the indies was like Psycho Killer. But it was it was like pretty generic. But yeah, they come in, they face off, the match kicks off, and it starts fucking hot.
This match was, I don't know, we've seen Gargano versus Ciampa so many times, right? And I feel like this match did it justice, but it was like a bite-sized version of it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, you know, Ciampa hits Gargano with the stiffest looking back elbow early on. And like, you know, and I think the commentators need credit on this too, because Moro was like, it looks like a tooth came out of his mouth. And then Brian was selling it, saying that, like, you know, I think Gargano is still out of his wits. He's been hit in the head, you know, like yada, yada, yada. So I think the commentary deserves as much credit as the two guys in the ring for this entire match. I don't know what you two thought, but
Mauro and Daniel Bryan are just a beautiful pair. What a great pairing of like technical knowledge for both of them. And Daniel comes in really hard with the heart. Mauro's like a very heartfelt, genuine person. And like, but Daniel at this point, this was before he came back.
This is the first thing that he did after he retired.
Yeah.
Right. This was the first role that they had him in after he gave his grateful speech. And it's that thing where it's like, you can tell that he is so enthusiastic and that he is so just like ready to be there.
And like to watch good wrestling under the WWE umbrella. Like you could tell like that all was super important for him. And like, you know,
you can tell that he feels like, we'll get into this later, but he feels what the wrestlers are feeling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like he 100% is behind them and going through what they're going through alongside them. And it's very raw, but very endearing.
Yeah. But so the biggest thing that stood out to me in the first little bit of this match, like even before we hit the elbow, is we kick off with some like really classic, like sort of like what we've come to know as like the Gargano kind of like grappling, like, you know how he always kicks off his matches with the like, oh, I'm going to go for this pinning combination and then float over and we're going to exchange pins and we're going to do a wrist lock and I'm going to flip out of it. Like, oh, we get all of that like Gargano token, like indie style wrestling.
Sure. Yeah.
And what was really interesting to me is that like a lot of the time when people come into NXT, we're like, oh, this guy's great. And like, he deserves to be at whatever spot on the card, he deserves to have the belt, he deserves to be on the main roster, blah, blah, blah. And it's really interesting to go back and watch this and see all of these like token trademark Johnny Gargano spots that are super clunky. And like, as compared to his matches now, where he is like absolutely as smooth as butter, and like watching where he was here, and it's not bad wrestling per se, but it is interesting to go back and watch someone that I've always thought of as like a really great wrestler and see like, oh, he did have room to improve. And he has, through the Performance Center and through the NXT system, he has gotten better and he has gotten smoother and he has been able to do these spots at an elevated level from where it is here. And like, that was a kind of, I was expecting to go back and watch like a beat for beat, boom, 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 2020 Johnny Gargano match. And it was interesting to see that he wasn't quite there.
Yeah, honestly, like, I think he nailed it. Like, if you look at this match compared to their future matches, and their future matches are all fantastic, right? Like, they're all, like, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 stars, depends on who you're asking. but, like, honestly, they had killer matches in the future, but you could really see the groundwork of their future matches in this match. And, like, it's less polished. But it was still raw, and it was good. Like, it was a really good fucking match. And, like, I think my one, you know, like, wish for this match is that they just had more time. Because they didn't have a lot of time. But I think the time that they had, they told a really good story in the ring.
Total.
Absolutely. And they like they seed the main parts early on. Like they seed the whole Tommaso Ciampa has to like decide. He has to rein himself in. Like there's multiple points in this match and it starts early off where he can pull down his elbow pad or pull down his knee. I think in the beginning it's his elbow. And he decides, like he unsheathes his elbow and then decides against it and puts it back because he realizes I can't injure my friend. I'm not here to injure. I'm here to hurt. And Johnny's my best boy. And
that ends up costing him the match.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful story of like it, in the beginning, you all you want is for him to do the right thing and side with Johnny and not hit him that hard. But then later that really costs him.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't do the unprotected knee shot. And Johnny takes advantage and does like a shitty roll up to win. And you really feel for Tommaso in that moment. Because his whole thing is that he feels inferior to Johnny. Like he feels like everyone...
He's a second fiddle.
Lauds Johnny over him. And like the fact that he got rolled up because he chose... Because he was holding back and he knew he was holding back out of love is so painful. And you really, really feel for him. And the post-match is so poignant. I don't know if you want to get into it yet.
Just real quick before we get to the post-match, there's a couple of spots that I want to shout out. There's a really great sequence where Ciampa goes for like an avalanche air raid crash off the top rope. Gargano like counters out of it to throw Ciampa to the outside, hits a dive, throws Ciampa back in, and then Gargano goes for that slingshot spear, and Ciampa just knees him in the face so fucking hard.
It looks good.
That entire, like, everything about that sequence is incredible.
Yeah.
And then we build to Ciampa actually hitting the air raid crash on the apron, which is, like...
On the hardest part of the ring.
Which Daniel Bryan calls out it is the hardest part of the ring. And then Ranallo makes something about how... He says, like, Tommaso Ciampa feels like the Garfunkel of this group, and rather than the sounds of silence, we're hearing the sounds of violence!
That's sick. Come on, that's sick.
I miss that man so much.
Yeah, but this match rules. Gargano does win with the crucifix pin after Ciampa hesitates with pulling down his knee guard. Before we get to the post-match, Josh, give us that bald head rating.
Man, I gotta give this 4 bald heads. I mean, like, how do you not? Like, I was gonna give it 3 7/8.
4 is low.
You know, like, just because of the length. But I just really like this match. You know, like, it's more of, like, the feeling I'm having when I'm watching it. And I feel like I was so invested in this match. Both guys did such a good job. And, I don't know, yeah, this was a beautiful kickoff to the great series of matches these two would have in the future.
Yeah. So we have the post-match. Lauren, do you want to take us through this?
Okay. So Johnny has the roll-up win.
Mm-hmm.
Ref raises his hand. And Ciampa can't even look at Johnny. The whole time that the ref is holding up the arms and doing the big congratulations, Ciampa isn't even looking at Johnny. And Johnny's got his big puppy dog eyes on. He looks real sad. All he wants is validation from his friend. And Ciampa can't shake his hand. Like, Johnny goes for a handshake of, like, please, no hard feelings. And Ciampa can't do it. And he walks away from his hand. And he gets out of the ring. Steps out of the ring under the ropes. And he takes a beat. And he goes, fuck. And then he gets back in and he can't shake Johnny's hand still, but he sits down cross-legged next to Johnny in the middle of the ring and he just sits with him for a second.
Shit
and
is
leans
beautiful.
His head on him, on his shoulder, and then he grabs him and puts his arm over his shoulder in an embrace, and it is total acceptance and total just like, I forgive you.
And he raises his arm while they're both sitting down together.
How many good moments like this are there in wrestling? where it's like they just put on a four bald head match.
Yeah. But that's the thing, like this post match, like this moment is why for me when I was watching it, this felt like a five to me. The first time we watched it together, I remember you and I were just fucking losing it for this whole match, and then this post match had us losing it, and they stoked this for this flame for so long, like there actually wasn't a blow off to this feud for a while.
Can I ask you both,
almost another year?
Yeah.
So I want to ask you both, do you think Johnny Gargano, Tommaso Ciampa is the feud of 2010 to 2020?
I have said countless times on this podcast that I think that Gargano Ciampa is the defining feud of this generation of wrestling, that I think this is the Michaels Hart of this generation of wrestling. And I think the only thing that kind of comes close, and it's more so in terms of match quality than it is storytelling, is the Omega Okada series.
Yep.
But I think this story has so much more heart to it. Yep. And I think this you will go back to Gargano Ciampa for the characters.
Yeah.
And the Omega Okada, I think, will be remembered more like a
classic
Misawa,
right?
Like it's going to be remembered more along the lines of like 90s All Japan, like a Misawa Tsuruta, or like a Misawa like in Noah later in the 2000s, like Kobashi. But where it's all about like the caliber of the matches that they put on, but this is about the characters, and this is about the story. This is your Hart Michaels of our generation.
I feel like Okada Omega is revered for its match quality, but Tommaso Gargano is revered for the character, for the storyline. And the match quality is amazing, but like it is the story that
I think
hits you.
That's not to say that like Omega Okada doesn't have story, because that is like the story of Omega Okada is Kenny's face turn in New Japan, and it's the story of him becoming the guy
For the company. And it's also like Ibushi, and like there's a lot of like that goes into it, and there's a lot of depth there. But like
totally,
just for intensity of I guess like hatred and vitriol, and like the stakes of the matches, and like the escalation of the matches, I don't think anybody did it better than Gargano and Ciampa. It's like every match, and they were all like 5-star matches. I'm not going to give them 5 bald heads, but they're all 5-star matches, right? Like they're all the best match you've seen in recent memory. And like every single one of them did it because you believed, right?
Except for the last one.
Well, the cinematic match doesn't actually count.
Yeah. Okay, I'm glad. Moving on, we have our first second round match that we picked. We have Lince Dorado and Rich Swann.
Can you handle this? Can you handle this?
Where is this Rich Swann in Impact right now? Like, I watch Rich Swann as, like, the current Impact heavyweight champion, and I'm like, this guy does nothing for me.
Well, I can tell you he doesn't have his like Cash Money Grills or whatever song behind him.
And
so
then we
and the wings
is on that
his
are is
tights.
That you trying to say CFO dollar sign?
Yeah.
Cash Money Grills. That's actually my studio project.
All right.
But like. Even commentary literally says when he comes out, it's like, what a fun guy to watch. You know, and like, it's like, I don't give a shit about Rich Swann as the Impact heavyweight champion, but like watching this, I am immediately invested in this character.
Yeah.
You know? He's fun.
He's just having a good time.
What a shitty man he probably is, allegedly, but like.
Putting his wife in headlocks.
Allegedly, yeah. But no, I remember being so taken with Rich Swann, and like he's so charismatic, and he's like the perfect balance of silly. He does a lot of dancing. He's very campy, but he can really dial it in with the intensity when he needs to. And he's a fantastic wrestler.
So
like, he does really amazing flippy shit.
Would you two consider me a young Rich Swann?
because you're so charismatic and flippy.
Can you handle this? Can you handle this?
Lince Dorado ain't no slouch either. I think, honestly, one of the best shooting star presses in the game.
Ooh.
100%.
Lince Dorado is so smooth. He moves so well. Like, I get the same feelings about him in the ring as I do about, like, Prince Puma / Ricochet. Like, he just has this je ne sais quoi, like, undeniable silkiness when he moves. Like, he just looks like he fucking lives and breathes wrestling ring and lucha. Like, just jumping and flipping and shit. Like, I can't even handle how smooth he is.
Can you handle this?
We'll come back to it again later, but I think it's, like, a huge disservice to Lince Dorado that they just, like, put him in a generic lucha stable when he hit main roster. That, like, this is a guy that, like, deserves to have a singles run.
100%. So if you look at Lince Dorado this match, so he reminds me a lot of Rey Mysterio, right? Like, I think during this entire match, and also huge props to Rich Swann, who had a great lucha match with Lince Dorado. Yeah. Like they both had a really solid lucha match. So the match starts off with, like, it's like a back and forth with, like, her Karanas, you know, like, flipping out of them. Like, it was a real lucha match. Like, like going into this, which I super respected. They had their little dance spot and all that, but
the dance spot was very cute.
It was. I liked Lince doing his, like, purposefully really bad dancing, where you're like, you can tell that he's a fantastic dancer and he's trying really hard to be a bad dancer.
Yes.
And make fun of Rich Swann. You're like, okay, Lince. Mm-hmm, okay. Yeah. I see you. You can dance.
We even get, like, there's, like, very quintessential lucha shit where I feel like when you go for these, like, big high-flying spots, like, there is a little bit more room to fuck up.
Mm.
And it's down to the caliber of the wrestler to kind of, like, save those spots and improvise and roll with it. And we get, like, there's a moment where there's supposed to be this big, like, avalanche Frankensteiner off the top rope that they totally botch and fuck up. And then immediately get up and look each other in the eyes and go, like, all right, we're going to save this. And they both just fucking big boot each other right in the face.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, you, like, 1,000%, like, totally took the heat off of that botched move by doing this, like, huge thing for everybody to just get invested in and move past the fact that you fucked up the last spot.
And that boot looked great.
It was great.
That boot looked
incredible.
It was like a double, like, scissor kick to each other. And they both went down like a ton of bricks. It looked so good.
Yeah. I don't have too much else to say about this match other than that it was just, like, a really good match. Commentary talks about Jushin Liger way too much.
It was the submission, right? Like, it was the submission that he had on him. And it was, like, I honestly, like, yeah, like, I'm with you. Like, I don't have too much else to say. I think both of them look so good. And you look now at Lince Dorado and you're like, it's a shame, like you said earlier, that he's in the stable, that he doesn't get his, you know, just due.
It's like, buddy, you could be Impact Heavyweight Champion right now.
Like Rich Swann.
The one other thing that I want to call out in this is that Rich Swann hits a Phoenix Splash and lands square on Dorado's face. And I felt really bad for Lince Dorado in that moment, but... Yeah. Rich Swann does win the match. Did you have anything else on this?
No.
Give us those bald heads, baby.
I gave it 3.5. I thought this was a solid match. No. You know, like, honestly, like, good back and forth. Good lucha match. Solid submission. Solid finish. And I also thought that you can see a star in the making with Rich Swann in this match. That was my big takeaway, right? Like... You knew coming out of this match that regardless of what happened with this tournament, Rich Swann was going to be all right.
Yeah.
He actually had a very compelling story throughout the Cruiserweight that they sold like in this match, but before it as well, with all of like one of the things I really liked about the Cruiserweight is they have a lot of like interviews and sort of promo segments where they tell you a lot about each wrestler's past and how they came to be a wrestler and like their whole character shtick. And it was quite fluid. Like they were really presenting them as athletes, as opposed like athletes with a story, as opposed to like heels and face characters. Yeah. Like, and it's good because they're in a tournament where they do have to flip flop sometimes between being heels and faces. Some, they're not always just a flat out face or a flat out heel. But Rich Swann's story in real life is very compelling in that, like, his father was murdered.
Yeah, and then when his mother died.
And then his mother died soon after, and he had to grow up really fast and had a really tough childhood in, like, a tough neighborhood. And that, like, speaks to anybody. I feel like that's, like, a very powerful story, and you're like, you just want good things for this person, or, like, you just have a certain amount of respect for this person. And it's interesting that in this tournament he presents as very like fun loving, which makes him even more endearing.
But, totally. Next up, speaking of the interview promo segments, we have Mr. Harry Potter's not the only wizard from Great Britain. Our second round match, we've got Zack Sabre Jr. versus Drew Gulak.
Really weird, like, production of Drew Gulak, I will say. Like, after all what I just said about Rich Swann, they do a really weird job with Drew Gulak here. They play, like, they're playing, like, really happy rock music under his like entrance and promo.
Well, and it's so before we even get to the entrance, it's like the Drew Gulak interview is like what I wrote down is that they can't.
This is what I'm talking about.
Okay, they can't decide if he's Daniel Bryan or if he's Timothy Thatcher. Like they want him.
Well,
to
his
be...
music is telling you one thing. His music is telling you he's Daniel Bryan, but what he is saying and the intensity with which he's saying it is that he's Timothy Thatcher. I want to hurt people.
I want to hurt people.
I love the pain.
But like, also, but also like, his interview. Oh. Also, his interview is like very reminiscent of like the first round Tyson Dukes interview, where it's like, I'm getting up there. I've traveled the Indies. This is my last shot. I need to. You know, I'm the underdog that's like, you know, like I need to do this. There's a little bit of Daniel Bryan, like, kind of faceness of that, right? With that's coupled with the Timothy Thatcher, like, I like to hurt people, I'm the submission guy. It felt conflicted, it felt a little confused to me.
For sure, and that's, like, this is, I feel like, an instance where they got a bunch of clips of him, and it just didn't quite work for this matchup. Like, they weren't sure what to do with him versus Zack Sabre Jr.
Yeah, which is a shame, because, like, I think that's always been their problem with Drew Gulak, right? Like, he is a character, but he's so technically proficient. And he's like a Daniel Bryan, and he's like a Zack Sabre Jr. But, like, I would say he's better in a lot of ways. Like, Drew Gulak is so good.
When
the crazy thing about Drew Gulak is he's so talented. He's so versatile. Like, he could really, like, he's really good at being a terrifying villain.
Yeah.
Like, Deadeye submission specialist. But I don't blame WWE for putting him in a comedic role
because he's
really
got talent.
Good at that.
But they did the same thing with Bryan. And but like they turned him back around to make him legitimate. They never went that step with Gulak, and they just kept him funny, right?
Gulak had like a 6-week run on 205 Live where he was an absolute monster heel.
Yeah.
And that was the best he has been booked since coming to the company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to like bring him to NXT. Like, I honestly think it's a move where you just like absolve 205 Live and fold it all into NXT. Give me Drew Gulak versus Timothy Thatcher.
Oh.
Like, oh. Give me a fucking, like, best of 11
I'm gonna shit my shorts. That's a match I want to see.
Zack Sabre Jr., little bit of a video package of him tapping out Tyson Dukes. I heard that apparently this match is the reason that Tyson Dukes has not been able to work in the States for the last 5 years. That apparently I heard that it was a thing where he lied about his visa to get down to do the tapings for 205 Live. And then when it was broadcast on fucking television, they found out and he got slapped with like a 5-year ban from the States for working dubiously legally. I don't know if that's like true or not, but I did read that on the internet. So
that's silly.
Take that with how you will. I do love Tyson Dukes. He almost punched me once at a super kick show because I was on my phone and not paying attention to him trying to clear room for a spot.
He's a true Canadian hero and he probably deserved it. So.
they bill Zack Sabre Jr. as 181 pounds, which is 4 fewer pounds than Kota Ibushi is billed at in this.
Oh my god.
And that is absurd.
He's not that tall.
So let's clear the air. Before you came into this match, Zack Sabre Jr., not a big fan, coming into this match, how did you feel after this match?
This is the first time we came across Zack Sabre Jr. This cruiserweight tournament is the first time we've met him. And man, it was a rough introduction with the wizard stuff. But his wrestling is good in this.
Josh, I think what you're getting at is like going back to this in the context of watching this in 2021 and how Lauren and I feel about Zack Sabre Jr. I was expecting to hate this match a lot more than I did.
That's so venomous. This match was fucking great.
Sorry.
It was good.
I really liked this match. I was expecting to hate this match, and I ended up really enjoying it.
Okay. I can take
it. I did. This is like one of my favorite Zack Sabre Jr. matches that I think I've watched going back and checking this out again.
Yeah, this is a good one. They did a good job with him in this tournament. Like, it seems like he cares about this tournament and they book it well where he's not making a fool of everyone and he's doing a really good fucking performance.
Lauren, you're just sounding like you're just like buying into this. I'll tell you what. This match was incredible. This match was so good. Both of these guys were on their game. Zack Sabre Jr., again, not my favorite wrestler on earth, but against Drew Gulak, these two put on a clinic. And I think Drew Gulak looked better than Zack Sabre Jr. in this match.
He 1,000% did. Especially because Drew Gulak comes out cosplaying as Zap Brannigan from Futurama.
Oh, I wrote a Star Trek character.
He's got the like really short skirt, which is a very
right.
Yeah,
ass
pure velour.
Suffering from sexlexia.
Yeah. but yeah, this match fucking slaps. Gulak looks so strong. There's a point when he throws on the Guerrero special, he looks like a million bucks. That spot was amazing.
The best spot of the fucking match. So Gulak gets Zack Sabre Jr. in the Guerrero special, Gory Guerrero's move, and then he crosses his arms over. So it's like, it looks so fucking good. That was the spot of the match, easy.
The other big spot that, like, actually my favorite spot was, because in the video package, we saw Gulak going off the top rope, hitting this massive lariat on whoever he beat in the first round. And then he goes up to do that spot again, and Zack Sabre Jr. catches him in midair and throws on an armbar. I fucking popped for that. That was great.
I popped for Zack Sabre Jr. like doing all of his weird submission-y bullshit, and mm-hmm. then he does his, like, I don't know, like, you know, where he bends over backwards and does he crosses his arms and he does his, like, asshole pin.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work because it's Drew Gulak. And Zack Sabre Jr., like, ends up winning this match with that same pin, but he doesn't cross his arms. He has to bend over backwards and use
and
his
arms
to hold Gulak down, and it looks really cool, and it's like a good moment of like,
it's storytelling, right?
Yes, and it's like putting his ego in check and being mm-hmm. like, fucking pin this man because he's a man, and like pin him like you mean it.
Yeah. And it's a thing where it's like Zack Sabre Jr. like sells in this match the way that like when we watched him facing Ricochet and Evolve, he wasn't selling for Ricochet
totally.
The way that he sells for Gulak in this match.
And I feel like his match against Ricochet seems more like a totally self-absorbed asshole boy given everything, given the spotlight, given the all the moves, given everything that he wants, whereas this is telling the story of an asshole boy going up against a really tough guy, and he has to, like, he tries to do his asshole-y, like, I'm the best, I'm a young man, I'm a submission specialist wizard shit, and it doesn't work, and he has to be more inventive and hit harder and be a better wrestler for mm-hmm. it. And I feel like he grows in this match against Drew Gulak, and that's why it's a good match for me, even though it's Zack Sabre Jr. It was a good match, I guess.
Yeah. Great fucking match for bald heads.
Agreed.
Next up in the quarterfinals,
we've got the Brian Kendrick versus Kota Ibushi.
You know what I love? Like right off the hop, like commentary so into this match. Brian mm-hmm. like
Brian
invested in both of these fucking guys. He's invested in like Kota Ibushi's kicks. Personally invested in like Brian Kendrick. Like
so much more invested in Brian Kendrick.
Yeah. I love how much
putting himself into Brian Kendrick.
It sells the stakes of the match so much how invested Daniel Bryan is in Brian Kendrick.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think we get the interview beforehand with like Brian Kendrick being so sincere.
Yeah.
And
I have to win this.
I have to win this. And it's great because it sets a tone for like when they started the cruiserweight division on Raw, and when they had the 205 Live, Brian Kendrick turned into sort of like the top heel for the first little bit of that run,
mm-hmm.
and it made that heel turn so much more potent. His all of his interview segments, he reminds me so much of the dude who is in. He reminds me of the actor from The Warriors. The dude who says Warriors.
Oh, yes.
But his delivery is like very much like, I saw who killed Cyrus. It was the Warrior. And that's like exactly the same tone.
That's how that he I has. Would deliver lines if I was a wrestler.
And he's also, which is, that actor is also the dude in The Crow that when Brendan Lee tapes him to the car seat and he says, there's no coming back. There's no coming back. And then he sets him on fire and blows up the car. Great actor. Brian Kendrick reminded me a lot of that dude. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great call.
Yeah.
But Daniel Bryan on commentary saying that Brian Kendrick has to win this match to prove himself. And like, mm-hmm. this is his last chance to get his dream.
Oh,
I think if he was
so rough.
I think if he was taking it that seriously, he probably could have come out without the social distortion pirate flag.
The flag that he doesn't hold aloft properly and totally fucks up flying.
Like that was a little weird.
Yeah.
I do like that the match kicks off with like Kendrick sort of, it's it's like the storyline is him as like the underdog to Kota Ibushi, and because of that he's resorting to like kind of crafty heel tactics.
Yeah, like they really told a good like story off the bat, right? Like, so definitely Kendrick was like slated at the heel, and like Ibushi is like the perennial babyface. Like, he's always going to be the babyface. Yeah, they both did a great job right off the hop of established like that. And yeah, and then like it starts off, Ibushi's kicks are fucking insane.
Yeah.
Like,
would you not fucking, how much would you pay to see Ibushi versus Aleister Black just kick the fuck out of each other?
Yeah.
I would pay like $7.
We got the Golden Triangle Moonsault, which is fucking beautiful.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Kendrick is doing all kinds of heel shit, and he's like leaving the ring, and he tries to like trap Ibushi's leg or foot in the fence.
A very Yano move.
There's a part where like Kendrick sort of like backwards knocks Ibushi's head off of the turnbuckle.
Neck breaker of the turnbuckle.
Oh, that was so good.
A neck breaker. I've never seen that done like that.
Yeah.
Backwards like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was sick.
I said, if you took a drink every time the commentary says surgically repaired neck during this match, you'd fucking die.
Oh my god, yeah. Oh, I have this spot written down. Ibushi does a ridiculous flip. He Pele kicks Kendrick's head, who's in the top corner.
Yeah.
I guess he's on the top turnbuckle, and Ibushi does a Pele kick to his head, which I thought was really impressive.
Ibushi also super impressively that fucking outside to inside German suplex.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Everything about this match was so fluid, so solid. There was no real mistakes that happened this match.
Yeah.
I think that's the most impressive part, right? Like, if you look at it, like, Ibushi's a star. And Kendrick played the kind of heel, I need to win this match, I know Ibushi's better than me kind of role so well throughout the course of this match. This was great storytelling, and it was a great match.
And it's the other thing that I want to shout out about this is that, like, we get into heel works body part.
Yeah.
Is heel works body part is a tale as old as time in wrestling. And some people do that really well, and some people do that very poorly. And this is a match where I think this is one of the best iterations of heel works body part. That we have the commentary selling the surgically repaired neck. We have Kendrick working the fuck out of that neck. And we also have, like, one of the big things for me is the way that they use the tournament formula to show that Brian Kendrick has won his matches with a bully choke. He's won his matches with a neck submission in the tournament. So when he hits the fucking burning hammer, and then he goes for the bully choke, we're already, like, keyed into the idea of this is how he's finishing the match, and it's putting pressure on the body part that Kota has injured. And it sells those spots so much more.
And the way they transition to it, too. Like, they transition so smoothly.
And when fucking Kota goes for the Phoenix Splash and misses, and he slaps on. And I mean, like, also we kind of just, like, glazed over the fact that Brian Kendrick hits a goddamn burning hammer in this
backwards
match.
Backwards on him, on his neck.
Yeah.
Oh.
Is fucking crazy.
He just breaks his neck.
If there were two spots that I remembered from watching the Cruiserweight Classic 5 fucking years ago, it's the air raid crash on the apron and the burning hammer.
Yep.
Those are the two spots from this entire tournament that, like, when you suggested it, I was like, we have to watch whatever two matches those spots happen in.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah. Kota does end up winning. Going on to the semifinal.
He does, like, super high power.
Oh, man.
Last ride, baby. The golden star.
Last ride.
Oh, sorry.
Before we get to the post-match again, Josh, hit us with those bald heads.
Man, how do you not give this 4.25? I don't know.
Ooh!
I love this match. Like,
whoa!
I honestly, like, if this was longer, it would have got, like, 4.5. Like, if it was a longer match, would it, like, it's that good. I just don't see a better match. And, like, the emotion, commentary was on point, the match was on point. Like, everything about this match was so fucking good. And, like, I had just watched, you know, the previous match before this, and I gave it 4 bald heads, and I was like, this match is better. It's like, this match, so it's got to get 4.25.
That's one of the highest ratings you've ever given.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
I love this match.
So, after the win, Daniel Bryan just starts weeping on commentary, giving Brian Kendrick all of the props, saying he's worked so hard, he's come so far, he's really...
But in the end, it didn't even matter.
Yeah, and like, Brian comes out, and he comes out from behind commentary, goes up on the ring, and he hugs Brian Kendrick, and they both just cry into each other and have a little, like, that shoulder chat that you always have. And it's so impactful.
Brian crying was, like, for sure huge. Like, that was so emotional. Yeah. Talking about, like, his last chance and, like, all this
just
stuff.
Just awful.
It's such a thing where it's, like, you, like...
Like, perfect awful, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's like,
awful.
The post-match here... And the post-match with Gargano Ciampa is a thing that is, like, I think kind of missing from a lot of wrestling right now.
Mm.
But I can't think of...
Like, the pure emotion as opposed to, like, manufactured...
Well, it's more so it's the idea of wrestling as storytelling and the match being the climax of the story. But, like, when you watch a movie or you read a book or, like, any kind of, like, story or whatever, is, like, the final... battle, if we're talking about like Rocky or we're talking about Lord of the Rings, is like the final fight isn't the end of the movie. The end of the movie is the fight is the catharsis, and the real end is what happens after, is the epilogue and dealing with the emotions. It's like the end of Rocky isn't the fight with Apollo. It's the end of Rocky is him crying out, Adrian, I did it. It's the emotional release after the fight. The end of Lord of the Rings isn't the destruction of the ring. It's them going
it's
back to
jump,
the Shire
jump, jumping on
and
the
going
bed.
Back. Yeah.
And
it's so it's like these matches have that moment afterwards. These matches have that moment where you are allowed to sit with it and you are allowed to explore how you feel about the story that you've just watched unfold, that the match isn't the end of the story.
And it's a real story.
Totally.
You know, like, and like, that's like so, it's so weird in wrestling to get a real story and for something to play out and it not work out. And like, you know, this should have been Brian Kendrick's last shot. And you know, Daniel Bryan, like, coming up with him and, like, all of that story just, like, behind it, you know, is so heartbreaking. It's so heartbreaking. And to, like, experience that at the same time in real time with Daniel Bryan, that was, like, that was real. That was so good.
Yeah.
It's the thing that I was thinking about when I was rewatching the Cruiserweight Classic is, like, look at the amount of storytelling and the amount of emotion and the what they were able to do with Gargano and Ciampa in a first-round match and compare that to how underwhelming the Omega Page blow-off as the finale of a tournament was in AEW. How they didn't allow to have that post-match, that, like, how do these two feel about this? And it goes back to us talking about, like, the letdown of the post-match of Cody versus Brody in the dog collar match, how we weren't allowed to breathe, how we weren't allowed to, like, sit with the denouement of these two characters, and that they're doing that so well throughout this tournament. Of all of the little smaller stories that they're telling, we are able to sit with at the end, they give an extra 2 minutes, you know, Cedric Alexander, like when he lost to Kota Ibushi, and they have that moment where Triple H comes out and gives him a hug and brings him into the back and says, yeah, I'll sign him. And it's like, there's all these smaller stories within the context of this tournament that we're able to live in and that we're able to sit with, that, like, I think right now we don't have those moments. Everything has to just roll over and move into the next thing.
Mm.
And that I think, like, you can go back and kind of look at this and pull this into, like, I think a lot of AEW stuff would really benefit from being allowed to sit with these emotions rather than have the manufactured, like, Cody Rhodes, like, grandiose promos or whatever.
Mm. Do you think the problem is, like, the actual stories or the announcing, or, like, do you think it needs, like, all of it?
I think it's just that thing where it's, like, doing too much storytelling in the match and not doing enough storytelling in the build-up and not doing enough, like, certainly far and away not doing enough storytelling in the post-match.
I see. Like, I would disagree. Like, I would say they're not doing enough storytelling in the match. Because, like, the only way we can believe this stuff is, like, if there's storytelling in the match, right? Like, if we believe what's going on in the match. And I think that Brian Kendrick, Kota Ibushi match, the storytelling in the match, the storytelling with the announcing, like, that was all the stuff I believed, right? Like, and that's what got me super invested in this. And sure, we've seen 1,000 matches where there's been false finishes and, like, really, like, dangerous stuff to, like, people's sore spots or just got surgery, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. But, like, it was the story they told in the match, the desperation that Brian Kendrick had to win the match, and then the announcing on top of it. That, like, it was all, for me, it was, like, that's what got me hooked. Like, that was, like, what sold me on it.
But it's, the difference is that at the end of that match, we get a moment where we get to sit with the loser. We get to sit with Brian Kendrick and feel what he feels.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, the equivalent in AEW right now, with both the, like, the Omega Page storyline, with the Cody Brody storyline, is that, like, we don't get a moment to sit with the loser. We don't get a moment to feel the repercussions of that. When Omega beat Hangman, the post-match was Omega being like, all right, now I have my sights set on Moxley. It wasn't about Paige losing. When Cody beat Brody, it was Cody being like, all right, now I'm going to face Orange Cassidy. It wasn't about Brody as the loser. And I think that's the thing, is that, like, the importance of the storytelling is more about the loser than it is about the winner sometimes. And that, like, these two matches in particular are so much more about Ciampa as the loser and Kendrick as the loser, because we know that there's more story to tell with the winner in a tournament formula. We know that there's more to come.
And that's,
so we're going to take the immediate moment after the match to sit with the loser.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, you know, if you think about it, because it's a tournament format, there's no story before the match. You know, like, between the two people fighting. But, like, the story is that person's story, right? Mm-hmm. And they do a bad job, I guess, of telling it, you know, nowadays. And I'm with you 100%, because I think watching this tournament, even watching just the matches and, like, the preamble to the matches, I was more invested in these two people than I was in anybody I'm watching now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
So we got our last match of the tournament.
Campbell's grand favorite
finale. We've got TJP, as they call him in this area, TJ Perkins.
Really gross. I hate calling him TJ Perkins.
Versus Gran Metalik. So when you were watching this, right? I feel like when I was watching this, Josh, who did you think was going to be in the finals?
When you looked at the brackets, I thought Kota Ibushi versus Zack Sabre Jr. Like, that was like
a... Right?
Yeah. That's who I thought.
For both of those dudes to lose in the semifinals was fucking crazy to me.
Crazy. And it's like, I did a little research because, like, I didn't know who TJP was. And I was like, oh, it's that guy from TNA.
Like, Pinoy boy.
But, like, I wasn't invested in the main event, like, honestly, at all.
No. I was. I remember I liked TJP. Like, I didn't know him before the Cruiserweight Classic, but the way they presented him to me and his wrestling and wrestling style is, like, undeniably fantastic and smooth. Like, he comes across as kind of like a young dick, but, like, that's a compelling part of his character, is that he's an ego-driven young man, and it's just fucking weird that he's not as young as he looks, but he seems like the young MJF ass, like, asshole young boy teen mm-hmm. who's like, I'm the best at wrestling. I was raised in wrestling. I was born in wrestling.
I was he born sounds like in the Bane. Wrestling.
Yeah.
We get a nice glory shot of the Orange County Choppers Cruiserweight Trophy.
That's a good observation. Good observation.
Yep. TJP comes out to, like, some generic ass music. Grand Metalik comes out to what sounds like the Voodoo Glow Skulls.
He's just like super bad Spanish horns. They're just like bam, bam,
bam, bam, nobody bam, remembers bam. The Voodoo Glow Skulls.
Did they play for Lucha Underground?
I don't know. They were like a bad ska band from the
90s. I never had to knock on wood. Is that them?
No. And then, what do you know, Triple H makes it a triple threat match when he comes out to...
What? No. He just comes out. He just comes out to wish them well wishes and to say, like, hey, y'all, this is... I'm raising the stakes. This is for a belt.
For an ugly-ass belt.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't great. I remember how fucking upset the internet was about this belt.
It was... What do you think was worse, the purple... Cruiserweight belt or an original TNT championship?
I think the purple cruiserweight belt was worse. Like, it's not a good looking belt.
I really don't like the WWE, like, the cruiserweight belt, and then they redesigned the intercontinental belt to be this really, like, old weird style? Like, kind of like art deco.
Yeah,
like, It looks like the fucking Leonardo DiCaprio Great Gatsby designed this belt.
Yeah. Yeah. It right? is a thing where they're just trying to go for a more modern typography and a more modern, like, clean yes. look, and it looks fucking bad.
The Roaring Twenties, what a modern look.
Campbell, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this cruiserweight belt. Like honest... it's undeniably clean and modern. Like, that's what they're going for. There's a lot of empty space, a lot of room for the purple.
Yeah.
The old, like, what's wrong with the old Intercontinental belt? Like, it's the best looking title. Like, the white strap.
Yeah.
It looks so fucking good. Why couldn't you just make a cruiserweight title that looks the same? Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
Straight up.
They don't have to all be vastly different. Like, they can just be cool belts. Like, they don't need to all have their own vastly different characterization.
No.
Yeah.
It's strange.
They don't need a vast difference.
Okay. All they need is a little portrait of the winner right under the...
right in the middle.
That was there. That was a good vast deference joke, and everybody missed it. All right.
No, we got it.
We all got it, John.
Whatever, let's move on. Let's move on.
I'm just going to bury the lead here, or I'm going to do the reverse of burying the lead here. This match is a completely, like... adequate run-of-the-mill match that is, like, completely shades of 205 Live to come.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I remember, like, looking back on the Cruiserweight Classic, I remember this really hard for, like, how much I loved TJP. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know why. He's emblematic of the Cruiserweight Classic for me. Like, I discovered him during this tournament, and he... like, was really cool, and he was someone I was really excited for, probably because he's very, like, lucha in his style, mm-hmm. and very different.
And because he dabs.
Well, I don't like necessarily that he dabs, but I like that it's so singular and it's so in keeping with his character. Like, to me, it's almost like, what's that, like, iconic crazy bitch right now? Who's...
Billy Kay?
Billy Kay would do something like that. Like, something really irritating and over the top, but it really fucking works with the character. Right. And you can't be mad at that. If, like, his character is that he's an asshole boy.
Mm-hmm.
And it works really well that he dabs, and it works really well that he does his little, like... He scissors his little ankles on someone's head and he does the fucking, like, spinny...
Dude, okay, so the fucking head spin shit was, like... He did it once and I was like, all right, fine, you got your shit in. And then he did it a second time and I was like, give me a fucking break.
But he never wins with that because it's not good enough. It's just a showy move for him and it bites him in the ass the second time that he does it. Like, it's not...
You know, I always felt that TJP would be better if he was somebody else. You know?
That's rude.
Well, no, like, if he had, it was like TJP, but another person's, I don't know, if another person had his body, I don't know.
Oh, you're just saying, like, the man isn't pulling off the gimmick enough? Like, he's not charismatic enough to sell it?
Because he's so good in the ring. He's so good in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, never can get behind his character or whatever he's trying to do. I just never get behind it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you two can relate to this.
Yo, fuck TJP.
Yeah, this is definitely a thing where, like, I feel like in most cases I always absolutely agree with this concept. But for some reason, TJP kind of works for me and I don't really know... why.
Yo, also fuck TJP for not catching Grand Metalik when he does that dive to the outside.
Doesn't catch him at all. He doesn't even little bit catch him. He just lands right on his fucking ass, like right on his back.
We get this amazing spot of like a running running Hurricane Rana to the outside, right? I think it's like Grand Metalik like runs, jumps over the top rope to hit a Rana.
Yeah.
On TJP to the outside, and then Metalik gets back in the ring, hits the ropes, goes for this fucking huge tope con hilo, and TJP doesn't catch him at all. Fucking sucks.
He just lands right on his fucking back, and then he has to sell it like TJP was the one who got rocked, and it is so rough.
Metalik also hits like an insane missile drop kick, followed up by a shooting star press off the top rope that is like... Grand Metalik is, again, like, going back to Lince Dorado, Lucha House Party, it is such a disservice to this dude that they're, like, just putting him in this generic stable, not giving him the run that he deserves as a singles wrestler, you know?
Yeah.
Dude is great.
He's so sick. He's so sick.
I agree.
I do like how this match ends with, like, multiple submissions where, like, TJP keeps going for a submission spot, and he keeps pulling Metalik, like, away from the ropes.
Dude, TJP keeps throwing on the knee bar in this match, and he doesn't know how to throw on a proper knee bar. Like, he fucking, like...
You should talk to T-Bar about that knee bar.
Yeah. Dude, go back and watch this match. He doesn't actually... And, like, I don't know if it was an attempt at storytelling... That he, like, doesn't sink it in properly until the very last one where he actually wins the match.
Do you get mad at John Cena for his fucking head thing?
Yeah! But it's, like, there's moments in this match where, like, TJP's throwing in a knee bar and he doesn't know, like, it's the thing where it's like, oh, he's grabbing his foot for extra leverage and he can't figure out which foot to grab.
Mm.
Is a thing that, like, I noticed this where I was watching and I was like, that looks like a weak knee bar. And he, like, grabs his right foot, and then he changes his mind and grabs Grand Metalik's foot, and he, like, he doesn't know how to sink in his signature submission hold until the last one. And again, maybe it was an attempt at being like, oh, like, now he has it sunk in properly, and that's how he won the match. But I felt like it was really clumsy storytelling for me.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, I thought it was a good story that was told throughout the match with the knee bar, like, multiply being applied. Like, I didn't notice too much that the knee bar wasn't sunk in properly. So maybe that's more on my end as a lazy casual.
I thought it looked like shit. I honestly thought all of his knee bars except for the very last one, terrible.
He did it with emphasis, right? So it's like he had the leg crossed, and then he slammed down his leg like in that figure four position.
Last one looked great.
So you know, maybe that was the story they were telling. It was like he was just like weakening the knee throughout the match. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I thought the knee bar story that they told was pretty good. Like, I liked it.
How many bald heads was it?
I gave it 3.5.
Yeah. How do you feel about seeing TJP's chest after, like, in the post-match when he's getting all of his awards and all of his trophies and all of his flowers? Belts. But his chest has, like, 25 popped blood vessels, so much little surface, like, internal bleeding happening.
You look like Hamburger.
It was fucked up. Grand Metalik, like, really fucked him up.
Yeah.
Really fucked him up.
We like to close out every episode here with a little high spot and a botch spot. Little honorable mention to something that we really, really liked. Little honorable mention to something that we didn't like so much.
Who's going to start us off?
Kick this one off. I'll go.
Okay.
So my high spot was definitely the Gargano Ciampa match.
Yeah.
It's to like the biggest comparison that I can make is like it's like going back and hearing like the demo version of like a song that you know and really really like. Like it's like the first time that you listen to like the Bad Brains Black Dot Sessions or like Cro-Mag's like Before the Quarrel demos where it's like, oh, I'm so familiar.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Okay. I understand that these are niche references, but this is the only thing that makes sense to me. But it's like a song that you've listened to over and over and over again, and then you go back and you watch like the groundwork and the foundation and like the demo version of it and like knowing what is to come. This was my favorite match of the entire tournament for the story that it told.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely fantastic. My botch spot is in the post-match interview after TJP wins, and they say, "How does it feel to be the first ever cruiserweight champion?" And I think that's a real slap in the face to Shinjiro Otani.
Boo. Boo this man. My high spot was everything to do with Kota Ibushi and Brian Kendrick. That whole match, commentary, everything about it, was like Taylor Swift's unreleased demo tapes when they first got released. I just loved it. It like there was a blank space and they wrote my name. And
nice.
I really loved everything about it. Daniel Bryan crying at the end of it because he genuinely loved Brian Kendrick and he was so upset because he knew how much this match genuinely meant to him. And even though wrestling's all pre-scripted, pre-booked, Brian had like a genuine crying reaction about it. Like, oh, this is like, it's so good. Like, I love everything about wrestling because of stuff like this. A low spot of the night. I mean, I would say, I don't know. Lindsay's hair. I mean, he had a mohawk. There's nothing bad. There's nothing bad about this night. Like it's really tough to peg down something that was bad about this. I think from what I saw with the Cruiserweight Classic, WWE is doing a disservice to themselves not to do something similar to this right now. Like honestly, like they need some kind of like refresh to like juice things up a little bit. And I think it's a shame that they're not doing it.
Yeah,
Everything was so good about this.
They could do another
one. Yeah. No low spot.
Yeah, okay. My high spot, because y'all have both mentioned my, like, the real high spot, so I'm going to give a little silly high spot, is just during the Gargano-Ciampa match, there's, like, a point where they're going outside the ring and walking through, not through the crowd, but, like, on the edge of the fucking edge of the crowd there.
The barricade?
The barricade, thank you. And there's a part where Johnny is, like, sort of leaning over on the barricade, and a member of the crowd just sort of does the most hesitant little, like, tap, like, little, like, caress, hand-tappy caress on Johnny's arm. He just taps his hand on Johnny's muscly arm as a, like, hey, like, good job, I love you. But, like, I don't know, it's so cute. It's such a, like, meek little gesture that I noticed that they caught on camera, and I was like, that's very sweet. You shouldn't touch wrestlers, but that's fucking so sweet.
Also, side note, speaking of muscly arms, how not jacked do Gargano and Ciampa look?
In comparison to how they look now, so thin.
Yeah.
Like,
teeny tiny little boys.
Yeah.
Little baby boys.
Fucking Gargano looks like so lean because he ends up being so vascular and like tight, like he loses all body fat. And Ciampa looks like 50 years younger. He looks like he's maybe like a teenager or like in his early 20s in this match because his face is so skinny.
He doesn't have that great big bushy beard.
Yeah, for sure. He looks so different. They both look really young.
What was your botch spot?
I don't really have a botch spot, so I'm just going to say it's when...
the CGI ninjas?
Oh my god, that was so funny. The little CGI, like, purple ninja man who pops up at the bottom left of the screen to say, Cruiserweight Classic, that's what you're watching. That's good. I was going to say when... TJP totally does not catch Grant Metalik as like a real bash.
That's a good one.
Yeah. That'll be it.
Alright.
If you got any thoughts on the Cruiserweight Classic, some stellar matches that we left out. We didn't talk about Tony Nese's abs.
Really wanted to.
You can hit us up at facebook.com/stonecoldshots. We're on Instagram and Twitter at stonecoldshotspod or stonecoldshotspodcast.
You can leave us a rating and review on any podcasting app of choice.
Give us those
leave
five,
us a positive review.
Five bald heads.
Five bald heads.